Okay, Apologetics 2, Lecture Number 13. Apologetics 2, Lecture Number 13. We're talking about the apologetic methodology of Norman Geisler. We said that Geisler is a Thomist. He basically uses traditional apologetics. His apologetic works, Christian Apologetics, Philosophy of Religion, and When Skeptics Ask. We mentioned that Geisler is one of the few traditional apologists who has taken some of the presuppositional objections to heart. He has not abandoned traditional apologetics, but he has fine-tuned it. Now, we mentioned that the first one-third of Geisler's textbook, Christian Apologetics, the first one-third covers methodology. It tries to answer the question, how do we find truth, or how can we test worldviews to find which world, which basic overall worldview, which view of reality is true. So part one, the first one-third of the book is methodology, how do we find truth? Part two is theistic apologetics. It takes the test for truth that Geisler arrives at in part one, and it tests the different worldviews, deism, pantheism, panentheism, atheism, and theism, to find out which worldview is the true worldview. Once he has found the true worldview, then Geisler puts the test of systematic coherence to the different religions within that worldview to find out which religion within the true worldview is the true religion. And that's Christian apologetics, or mainly historical apologetics is what he does in part three. So he does also make a defense there for supernaturalism as opposed to naturalism. In other words, God can perform miracles. So Geisler, unlike the other apologists, as we mentioned last week, you don't have to read 17 or 18 of his works. It wouldn't hurt. I mean, Geisler has written over 40 books, and they're all dynamite, but you can read just this one text, Christian Apologetics, and you have his apologetic methodology spelled out. The other guys, you have to kind of piece it together. They didn't write any book that, they didn't write any book that had the purpose of expressing their apologetic methodology step by step, whereas Geisler did with his Christian apologetics. Remember, Geisler, in his methodology, how do we find truth? He looked at all the different ways to find truth, and he found that they failed. Agnosticism fails, pure rationalism fails, fideism fails, experientialism fails, evidentialism fails, pragmatism fails, and then even combinationalism fails, combining these different things. Now, when Geisler talks about combinationalism, what he's talking about is just throwing these other ways to find truth, just throwing them together. But there is a way that he puts some of them together in a way that does work, because some of these, pure rationalism and evidentialism, they do serve a purpose in the proper context, but they have to be put in the proper context to test truth. So Geisler closes his first section on methodology with the adequate tests for truth are threefold. Number one, unaffirmability. If a worldview is, or some major essential tenet of it, is unaffirmable, in other words, if it contradicts itself, then that will tell us that the worldview is false. But it doesn't tell us, just because a worldview is consistent, it doesn't tell us that it's true. Okay? But if a worldview contradicts itself, it must be false. So unaffirmability is a test for the falsity of a worldview. Geisler then uses actual undeniability for the test of a true worldview. In other words, if we can find something that is actually undeniable, and that premise leads, that's not logical necessity, rather than logical necessity, it's existential undeniability or actual undeniability. In other words, I must exist in order to deny my own existence. I must be an actual being in order to deny my own existence, okay? So actual or existential undeniability is a test for the truth of a worldview. And then he uses systematic coherence, which is combinationalism, but combinationalism cannot test to determine which worldview is correct, but you can use it to test the truth statements within a worldview. In other words, Once you find the true worldview, then you can use the systematic coherence or combinationalism to find which religion within a worldview is true. Consistency, it must be non-contradictory. It must have empirical adequacy. In other words, it must explain all the relevant facts. It just can't ignore things that they don't like. Atheism must answer to things like morality. They can't just ignore it and whitewash over it. And then it must have experiential relevance. In other words, it must be, your worldview must be livable. Okay? And so with these adequate tests for truth, Geisler then goes into part two, theistic apologetics, and tries to answer the question, what is the true worldview? Now, by the way, I'm not going into... I'm just going to say that he shows that deism, pantheism, panentheism, and atheism, each of these worldviews fail. We covered last week why they fail. And even when we covered it last week, this is not a course on Geisler's apologetics. It's a course on apologetics, and we just happen to throw out a lecture and a half on Geisler. So even last week when we covered why they fail, we only covered what's on the handout, and it's not really in-depth enough to where we're doing justice to the system that Geisler has. He's much more in-depth, but I try to take the best points, in my opinion, what were the best points, the best refutation of these systems, whereas he might give 10 or 12 points why pantheism fails as a worldview, and why it's unaffirmable, and I just pulled out a couple of his points, because we just do not have the time to go through all of them. But then Geisler argues that theism is actually undeniable. Now, I can't take time to defend his premises, but I'll read from page 238 and 239 of his Christian Apologetics, published by Baker Bookhouse. This was the book that I forgot last week. And I'm going to read his 10... After disproving all the other worldviews, then he turns to theism, the worldview that teaches that there is an infinite personal God who exists separate from the creation. He's transcendent, but is also involved with his creation. He is immanent. And Geisler argues for it, and he has 10 points, 9 premises and a conclusion in his argument, found on page 238 and 239 on his chapter on theism in Christian Apologetics. Point number one, Geisler argues that some things undeniably exist. And he uses as an example that I cannot deny my own existence. In other words, I have to actually exist in order to deny my own existence, so it's actually undeniable that I exist. Nothing is nothing, therefore nothing can do nothing, therefore nothing can deny nothing. If I can deny my own existence, I have to exist in order to make the denial. And so Geisler argues that some things undeniably exist, i.e., I undeniably exist. Okay? You can even take that further, too. You could begin to argue that by debating someone, you are also affirming their existence as well. In other words, you can go into a closet and turn off the light, close the door, and scream out at the top of your lungs over and over again, "Only I exist, only I exist," and that's not self-refuting. But once you tell another person that only you exist, then that's self-refuting, because you're assuming the existence of the other person in order to deny their existence. Yeah.
You can claim that you're a pigment of your imagination.
What's that?
You can claim that you're just a projection of your imagination.
Yeah, but even there, they're communicating with that figment of their imagination. So they're actually asserting the... In other words, if we say that there's only one mind that exists, but we're trying to prove that point to someone else, what we have is one mind trying to persuade another mind that the other mind doesn't exist. And so it's actually, it's a contradiction there. So Geisler argues that my existence is actually undeniable. But then the point number two, he argues that my existence is possible. In other words, it is possible for me to not exist. That certain things were taken from me, such as air, food, water, I would cease to exist. So my non-existence is possible. Point number three, Geisler argues, whatever has the possibility not to exist is currently caused to exist by another. Now, he's not arguing for the cause of the beginning of my existence. He's not arguing for my parents and their parents and their parents. He's arguing for something that has to keep me in existence right now. And if I say, well, I need air, I need water, I need food, those things are currently causing my continued existence. They're my sustaining causes. They sustain me in existence. However, if they also need causes, if they're also limited and dependent on something else, then ultimately they are not the sustaining cause of my existence. Eventually we have to keep getting beyond these dependent beings until we get to a being that is totally independent, that is not dependent on anything outside of itself for its own existence, and that would ground the current continuing existence of all else that exists. Number four, there cannot be an infinite regress of current causes of existence. If you could keep going on and on infinitely for the current cause, you would never arrive. Every cause would also be an effect and would have a cause, so you would never reach this independent being that is the ground of all dependent existence. Okay? So basically, it would be like having a chain rising up into the sky, and you say, well, how is this link on the chain? How is this just hanging in the air? Well, because it's being held up by the link above it. Well, how is this one being held up? Well, it's being held up by the link above it. Well, that can't go on and on infinitely. Eventually, you have to reach a link of the chain that's hooked up to a nail on the wall, something that's holding it up. And it's the same here that Geisler is arguing for, much in the manner of Thomas Aquinas. Point five, therefore a first uncaused cause of my current existence exists. A totally independent being must exist to ground in existence all the caused existence, dependent existence that exists. Point six, this uncaused cause, Geisler argues that it must be infinite, that's unlimited, unchanging, all-powerful, all-knowing, and all-perfect. Now, we're going to argue much in the same fashion. I think I've simplified it a little bit, and hopefully I didn't lessen the force of the argument. But when we get to that point, when we provide evidence for God's existence, we're going to argue along the same lines. Here, we're just giving an overview of Geisler's thought. So I don't want you to think that I'm doing total justice to Geisler's argumentation. In fact, this whole entire chapter is just this one argument. But he argues that this uncaused cause must be infinite, unchanging, all-powerful, all-knowing, and all-perfect. Point number seven, this infinite being is appropriately called God. Point eight, therefore God exists. Point nine, this God who exists is identical to the God described in the Christian scriptures. Point 10, which is the conclusion, therefore the God described in the Bible exists. And so he argues for the truth of Christian theism by arguing that the other worldviews are actually unaffirmable, whereas Christianity is actually undeniable. He argues that his first premise, that something now exists, is actually undeniable, and that all the other premises flow from that. Therefore, the conclusion is actually undeniable that God exists. And so that's where Geisler closes the second section, that theism is the true worldview, that there is one personal God who is infinite in his attributes, and who exists above the universe and apart from the universe. He is transcendent, but he is also directly involved with this universe. He sustains it in existence, and he can perform miracles and can intervene. He is immanent. And so the God of theism exists. So then section number 3 of Geisler's book is his Christian apologetics, which basically, for the most part, is historical apologetics, and it tries to argue which theistic religion is true. And now, just to say that we prove theism doesn't mean that we prove Christian theism, because the Islamic faith and Judaism also believe in the God of theism, an infinite personal God who is transcendent and immanent. But Islam and Judaism fail the test of systematic coherence, whereas Christianity passes the test of systematic coherence. Geisler has chapters in there. By the way, each one of these points, except for maybe point A under section 3, each one of these points is actually an overview of a chapter in Geisler's work. Okay? So keep these handouts, maybe get a copy of the lectures, and that'll really help you get through Geisler. It took about 3 or 4, I only had about 2 or 3 philosophy courses before I read Geisler's work, and it took about 4 or 5 readings before I really started to grasp what he was getting at. Okay? But section 3, Christian apologetics, which theistic religion is true? Christianity passes the test of systematic coherence. One of the chapters, the first chapter in this section, he deals with the question of naturalism and supernaturalism, and he argues that if the God of theism exists, miracles are possible. And not only are they possible, but you would expect him to care enough. If he created the universe and sustains it in existence, you would expect him to care enough to be involved with it, maybe even to the point of performing miracles. So miracles are possible. Then he has a chapter on objectivism and history, and he argues that history is as objective as modern science. Both deal with probabilities. You know, when you deal with modern science, you are not dealing with universals. You're studying the particulars and trying to figure out what the universals probably are. Okay? So you're not doing deduction, you're doing induction. You're arguing from the particulars to the universals, so you're dealing with probabilities. So to say that because we can't be logically certain that Napoleon Bonaparte existed, because history only gives us probabilities, if we take that view, then we would also have to take that same view for modern science, which most atheists are not willing to do. By objectivism, he means that we can find objective truths about history with high degrees of probability. Okay? That's in response to subjectivism, which would basically say that the historian makes his own history. Okay? And Geisler admits, just like J.P. Moreland admits, that the historian he's just like a scientist, he's going to decide what factors he brings into his equation. He's going to have to interpret certain things that he might not have a whole lot of evidence for, such as why did Napoleon do what he did. But when everything is said and done, if two people disagree, it doesn't mean that they're both right and that history is subjective. It means that possibly one of them, at least one of them, is wrong. Maybe they're both wrong. Okay, but history is objective, and miracle claims can therefore be historically tested. So, the first chapter of section 3, he's arguing that miracles are possible. Part 2, the next chapter of part 3, he argues that miracle claims therefore can be historically tested. And then Geisler, from that point, argues that the New Testament manuscripts are historically reliable. He then argues for the deity and the authority of Christ through the resurrection of Christ from the dead, the historical evidence for the resurrection of Christ from the dead. And then from the statements of Christ in this reliable New Testament, he argues for the inspiration, that the Bible is the inspired Word of God, and therefore it is the highest authority that man has. God, if God has spoken, then man should submit himself to the Word of God. And so Geisler, usually most guys, John Warwick Montgomery would start his apologetic works with part three. Okay? He would start, in fact, he would start with part three, point three down there at the bottom. He would start right with the historian. There's nothing wrong with doing that so long as you let people know that there is some foundational work, philosophical work that needs to be done before you get to this point. Montgomery doesn't do that, and that's why he gets nailed a lot. Dr. Gary Habermas, one of my professors at Liberty University, he would start with point three on the handout, the historical reliability of the New Testament, but he would openly admit, and does so in print, that this all assumes that your theistic apologetics has been done first. And so most guys start way later than Geisler. You do have Craig Moreland, William Lane Craig and J.P. Moreland, two great defenders of the faith. They start with point number two, theistic apologetics. Geisler is one of the few guys that even realizes that we have to answer the question, how do we find truth, before we can even get into theistic apologetics. So the whole first one-third of Geisler's book is something that most Christian apologists don't even touch. Now at this point, that's the apologetics of Geisler. We've talked about Geisler, Gordon Clark, Cornelius Van Til, and Francis Schaeffer. And the next lecture we're going to go into is the failure of atheistic arguments. But if anybody has any questions, we've got some time right now. I could try to answer those questions about any of the four Christian defenders of the faith that we've discussed up to this point. Or if you have any other questions to do with Christian apologetics, you can ask me. Yeah, Jeff.
If God could be revealed with logical certainty, objectively, then people would be compelled to believe that God would be no reason for faith, right?
Well, it all depends how you define faith. Aquinas defined faith like that, that you couldn't know and believe the same thing at the same time, because if you knew it, then there was no room for doubt, and you couldn't disbelieve. I take a different position. I take a position that you can know something with absolutely no doubt at all, but you can still choose to deny it. You can still make a moral choice to believe something else, even though the evidence has been proven to you. Now, things with logical necessity, I think we know very little with logical necessity, but I think that there is a certain certainty. There is a type of certainty that we have about God, but we cannot call it logical certainty. Some would call it moral certainty. I would probably tend to call it personal certainty. There's some way that all mankind are in contact with the personal God of the Bible, but most men choose to suppress that truth. In fact, all men suppress it to a certain point, and then a lot of us give up suppressing that truth, and we end up accepting God's witness to us in creation and conscience, and then eventually we accept Christ when the gospel message is presented to us. But most men suppress that truth. But I think Blaise Pascal was right on when he argued that the heart has its reasons of which reason knows nothing. And that when we act like man only knows things with logical necessity, or logical certainty is the only kind of certainty there is, I think we're making a straw man. We're not really dealing with man as man really is. We make so many of our decisions. It's like if the missus says, "Hey, you feel like going out to get a bite to eat at Sbarro's? Get some pizza." The logical thing to do might be to say, "No, we're kind of short on our budget, and it's going to be real hard because we're going to need that money to pay this bill or that bill later on." But a lot of times, I start thinking about that pizza, And so, but I think that there's a lot more decisions beyond just going out to eat that we make that goes beyond rational data and goes into our tastes, moral choices, that type of thing. And I think when men refuse to bend the knee to the God of the Bible, it's not because of a lack of evidence, as Paul would say in Romans 1. It's basically because they choose to suppress the truth, because like John says in John 3:19-21, they love the darkness more than the light, and they don't want to come to the light because then their evil deeds will be exposed.
One more question.
Sure.
I think Francis Schaeffer had the biggest effect of all the apologists.
Mm-hmm.
I think your point of contact was the Holy Spirit.
Yeah, well, I think that Schaeffer... Tom Morris slammed Schaeffer, assuming that he's a philosopher from Notre Dame. He assumed that Schaeffer, since he went to, was taught by Van Til and had tremendous respect for Van Til at Westminster, he assumed that Schaeffer was a pure Van Tilian apologist. When Schaeffer wasn't, he kept a few things from Van Til, but he basically developed his own system that was a lot closer to Carnell than it was to Van Til. And having said that, Tom Morris is a guy who wrote a book praising Blaise Pascal for dealing with the whole man. Yet I think the closest thing to a modern-day Blaise Pascal that we've had is Francis Schaeffer, maybe with the exception of Ravi Zacharias today. And I don't know why Morris would praise Pascal and then slam Schaeffer, when I think Schaeffer was a lot closer to Pascal than he actually was to Van Til. In fact, there's some areas where he dealt with Schaeffer as if Schaeffer was a pure rationalist. And when Schaeffer would use necessary, the word necessary, that this is the necessary conclusion, and that the Christian worldview is necessarily, people live as if the Christian worldview is necessarily true. He's not talking about rational necessity. He's talking about existential necessity. Not that Christianity can be proven with rational certainty, but that everybody lives like Christianity is true. And so, yeah, I think Schaeffer had the big... There's probably three reasons why Schaeffer had a bigger impact. I mean, Schaeffer actually converted people through his works. Whereas most of the other apologists just make defenders out of the faith, out of Christians. And I think the reason why Schaeffer had the biggest impact, number one, he was a great writer. Number two, it was more of an armchair philosophy rather than an academic philosophy. You didn't feel like you were being lectured in a classroom. You felt like you were sitting down in a rocking chair talking about the philosophy with another guy sitting down in a rocking chair, both smoking pipes in front of a fireplace. And it just gave you a comfortable atmosphere. And I think Schaeffer, whether you like him or don't like him, I think he should be judged in that approach. His writings were conversational, not academic. And so I think his being a good writer and it being so down-to-earth, his writings. But then third, the fact that he was willing to deal with more than just the mind of man and really try to touch on the heart and the will and the emotions, much like Blaise Pascal. I think that's probably why he could be classified as the most effective Christian apologist of the last... 30, 40 years, probably the most effective Christian apologist since C.S. Lewis. And that should also tell us something else. Schaeffer was not a trained philosopher, nor was C.S. Lewis. But they both were extremely learned men who had years of both formal training, and then they were very well read. Okay? I do not believe scholarship... has to be produced on a college campus, although these guys did have college credentials. But at the same time, I believe that the work has to be scholarly. In other words, you have non-trained guys that aren't doing scholarly work, and you have trained guys that aren't doing scholarly work. And you also have guys with academic PhDs in their field doing scholarly work, but you also have guys with no college training at all doing scholarly work. And Schaefer falls into that latter category. Very well read, did a great job, and yeah, academic philosophers can slam him on a lot of inaccuracies. I think he misrepresented Aquinas on throughout his writings, and the fact that Norman, if you really want to understand Aquinas, read Geisler's works on him and Peter Kreeft's works on him, the Catholic philosopher Kreeft or Kreft. I've heard it pronounced both ways. But even Kreeft's work on Blaise Pascal, Christianity for Modern Pagans, he argues that Pascalian apologetics, it would be the most effective apologetics in our day and age, because we've got a bunch of New Agers out there who care more about emotions and the will than they do about reason. And so we need a return to Pascalian apologetics. But even there, throughout, as he's commenting on Pascal's Pensées, his defense of the faith, throughout he shows that what he is saying is very close to what Aquinas is saying in almost every area. And you could even argue that when he says that Pascal is saying he doesn't give much weight to arguments for God's existence, you can even argue that, well, Aquinas didn't either, because his five ways for God's existence take up three pages in a you know, 2,000-4,000 page work. So there really wasn't much difference between the two, and maybe just a difference in emphasis, but not really a difference in their overall. And Pascal was not slamming Aquinas; he was slamming Descartes, a pure rationalist. And Aquinas could never be classified as a pure rationalist.
What book would you suggest to read that would help us to condense and simplify the apologetics and what people will learn to apply it to our point of contact also?
If you're going for it, here's the tough thing. It's like in my dissertation right now is about 490 pages long, and I'm trying to get it ready to send it on in, and I only spent about 15 to 20 pages on testimonial apologetics, just sharing your testimony with others, whether it's how Jesus transformed your life or if God has intervened and performed a miracle in your life. The reason why I don't spend a whole lot of time on them is it's the least, from a logical standpoint alone, it's the least convincing. It is the furthest from logical necessity that you're going to get out of any of the other methods of apologetics. At the same time, it's probably the most effective. So I think that the work, Pascal's Pensées, a one-volume work, that would be a good work. And then Peter Kreeft, or Kreeft, I asked Moreland how you pronounce it, and he said he's heard it pronounced both ways as well. In fact, he even came up with a third pronunciation of it. His work, Christianity for Modern Pagans, which basically, in fact, get that instead of getting Pensées, because he's got about all the famous Pensées are in there, and then he just comments on them. And so in one shot, you can get that one book that would really go a long way to... And the funny thing about Pascal, too, he was a Roman Catholic. At the same time, he was very sympathetic to the Jansenists, who were basically five-point Calvinists. Okay, so this guy was a Roman Catholic in name only, and he pretty much was a five-point Calvinist who made a lot of waves during his day. Pensées? K-R-E-E-F-T.
You say that he's a 5-point Calvinist.
I shouldn't even say 5-point Calvinist. Maybe they didn't even figure out the point on limited atonement, but they went back to Augustine, and so they really believed that we don't freely choose Christ. You know, God does that.
It seems strange to me to refrain of Ponte to affect try to get your heart or your will.
It's pretty much, why would you, if God zapped you, if regeneration precedes faith, if 5-point Calvinism is true, why try to persuade a person to Christ? But you can make just as strong of an argument for why even witness at all. But the response is going to be, and it's a simple response, and in one sense it's good, in another sense it's very weak, and it's that, well, God commands us to. And so that's what they're going to constantly say. Gerstner says it. Sproul says it. God might want to use us as an instrument to get this thing done. Well, the fact of the matter is, if God really, in the most consistent Calvinistic view, if he really wants it done and God wants to use us, then we're going to be used to God whether we like it or not. So, you know, it's a weird system. It's definitely Geisler's approach is that God is sovereign and man is free, and it's a mystery. We'll never reconcile it this side of death. But I think through Molinism, I think that there's a good solid reconciliation available to us. Okay, any other questions at all? Okay, let's move on to the failure of atheistic arguments. Now, here we get into my own. We done in this course.
Is that a handout too?
What's that? Oh yeah, I handed it out last week. So see if you got it there. Otherwise, you might have to look on with Lucky on it. The failure of atheistic arguments. What we've done so far in this class, we have. We went over the biblical basis for Christian apologetics as an introduction. Then we went into 8 key people in the history of apologetics, and I believe 4 key people who attacked apologetics in history. And then we went into 4 leading Christian apologists of the last half of our century, in Van Til, Clark, Schaefer, and Geisler. And now what we're doing is, now we're just going to begin our argument for the existence of the God of Christianity and the Bible as God's Word. And we're going to take it one step at a time. We're going to discuss the failure of atheistic arguments. And by the way, we'll be touching on philosophical apologetics, which this is on that topic right now, and we'll be on that for a while. But philosophical apologetics, we'll touch on scientific apologetics, historical apologetics. We already discussed several guys that are presuppositionalists, so that's the presuppositional apologetics. We're not going to get into testimonial apologetics. We touched on psychological apologetics when we dealt with Blaise Pascal. So we've pretty much covered all bases, with the exception of comparative religious apologetics. But we've got a pretty good overview. And it's not my job to force you to take my apologetic methodology, so much as it is my job for you to come up with your own apologetic methodology and to try to fine-tune it as best as possible. At the same time, keep in mind that you don't use one method for everybody, and find out where the person is before you begin to, you know, give arguments for God's existence and you find out the guy believes that God exists, or give heavy rational argumentation to a guy who could care less about reason. He's just looking for meaning in life. And get to know the people that you're dealing with but I'd like you to come up with your own apologetic methodology. Okay, the failure of atheistic arguments. Brief introduction to this. We need to define atheism and agnosticism. Atheism is, but by the way, the definitions that I'm giving are the classical definitions. You will not find that when you deal with Michael Martin, his book, Atheism, a Philosophical Justification. He also has another work, The Case Against Christianity. Michael Martin's the new kid on the block, okay? He's the new Bertrand Russell. You can see the size of this Atheism, a Philosophical Justification. He did his homework. It's a lot of stuff in here. But with a good philosophical background and a good apologetic methodology, it's not real hard to tear up. But he basically, Michael Martin, is the best that the atheists have to offer right now. I recently called my old professor, Dr. Gary Habermas. He presented a paper refuting Martin. Martin considers Habermas, one of my professors, the leading defender of the resurrection, the historical evidence of the resurrection. So he mentions him in his works. And Habermas wrote a brief paper refuting Martin there. I've also already listened to 14 lectures by Greg Bonson refuting Martin from a Vantillian viewpoint. And I'll tell you, the Vantillian viewpoint is a good approach to take to Martin because it shows that Martin has no basis whatsoever for even writing a book. And he shows in Martin's own writing where Martin basically tells you he has no basis for doing what he's doing, but he's going to do it anyway. I mean, he comes right out and says that there's no real accepted secular epistemology. In other words, he's saying current non-Christian philosophers have not figured out how man can know truth, or even if man can know truth. But we're just going to set that aside and assume that we can find truth, and now here's my book. And so that's really weak. Now, what Bonson argues, the way Vantil would argue as well, Bonson argues that if you don't accept the God of the Bible, if you don't presuppose the existence of the God of the Bible, you'll never find a solid epistemological base. You'll never have a basis for knowing anything. And so basically, where Bonson and Vantil would try to corner somebody, Martin starts right there. So, I mean, he's counted out before he even starts with a Vantillian. And that's one of the strengths of the Vantillian apologetic. So I'm basically, now what I'm doing now is I'm going through his argumentation against the cosmological arguments. Because Vantil and Bonson would agree with Martin's objections to the cosmological, teleological, and moral arguments. But I'm a traditional apologist, and so now I'm doing my work in that area and looking into that. But basically, this is from a scholar. He's a professor, philosophy professor at Boston University. This is a pretty good attempt, though, by an atheist, because usually you get leading philosophers like Bertrand Russell writing watered-down pop books. You know, like Why I'm Not a Christian, just a bunch of his essays put together. And I was so disappointed when I bought that book to see, I could have got better argumentation from an atheist garbage man than I got from Bertrand Russell, the great mathematician and philosopher from Great Britain. And if you've ever read the transcript from his debate with Father Copleston, the Jesuit priest, you'd see that when he locked horns with someone of was as well read as him, he did not do well when the issue was God's existence. It's a good attempt, but this is really the best that they have to offer, and it is weak to say the least. And he says a lot of things that you can hammer him on over and over again. Someday we'll do a course on Michael Martin, and they will have a good time. We'll have a real good time with that. Oh, by the way, he was supposed to debate Bonson, and 2 weeks before the debate, he bailed out. And so Greg Bonson's people their monthly newsletter apologized that the debate never came about and said, you know, Michael Martin pulled out. And they said Michael Martin claimed that he pulled out of the debate because he didn't want any funds, any of his efforts to raise funds for Bonson's ministry. They said, now whether that's true or not, we'll let you decide. However, here's a list of the materials that Michael Martin ordered from Bonson's ministry a couple of weeks before he pulled out of the debate. And he ordered the two cassettes of Bonson debating Gordon Stein on Does God Exist? And he also ordered the 14 lecture series of Bonson refuting Michael Martin. So it is probably a different motive behind why he bailed out of the debate. Now, I don't blame him. Bonson is a tremendous, tremendous philosopher par excellence, so I wouldn't agree with him in a lot of areas. Let's just close out this lecture. We'll pick up the next lecture, The Failure of Atheistic Arguments.